This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. We're also pleased to welcome back to the show Brian Johnson. He's a professor of journalism at University of Illinois. He teaches photojournalism. He's been a newspaper photographer and knows a lot about cameras and film and lenses and everything that goes into taking pictures. And every once in a while, we have him come here on the show to talk about where things are with the art and also to answer questions. And we thought maybe this would be a good time of year to do it. We expect that some folks will be thinking about vacation and wanting to document their trip, and they may have questions about these sorts of things. So whatever's on your mind, photography-wise, you can give us a call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. So if it would be long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Anything really new and exciting?
Really new and exciting. Something that I saw recently that was kind of interesting. You know, we've talked about the APS film system, the what Kodak calls Advantix. And they one of the advantages of the Advantix film is that there's a magnetic coating on the film, so you could record an audio annotation and some things like that. Well, now Kodak has come out with an APS system that has essentially a little digital camera built into it. So when you take your picture on the film, you can then press a little button, or maybe it just comes up automatically, and it'll show you a preview of the picture that you just took.
So, is that really a necessary feature?
I thought that was kind of, I can tell you from shooting with a digital camera that every time I shoot a picture, I'm looking at the preview to see, you know, is it in focus? How was the framing? You know, did someone have a, you know, poor expression on their face or something like that? So it is neat in that it's a film camera that you can also get a preview on. So you do have the film, so it's not just purely a digital product you're going to
have. So that way you can check and see basically how was the picture.
Right, exactly. Really did someone blank, or do I need to reshoot it, or whatever?
Okay. Well, we have a caller here ready to go. Let's take them in Urbana, line number one.
Howdy.
Hello? Yeah.
You do newspaper photography, right?
Uh-huh.
I would like to make a suggestion.
Sure.
Hopefully pass on to people in this profession. I've been in the paper a couple of times, and one of the things that happens is that the photographer and the person writing the article and the person writing the caption don't seem to talk to each other very much.
Right.
And no matter how good the picture is, if you get a caption that would go on Jay Leno, then it kind of ruins the situation.
Right.
And I have been made to look like an idiot.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Sure.
By somebody putting a caption under my picture that said I didn't know what I was talking about.
Right. Right.
Because the person who's writing the article is writing it on a PC. The person doing the graphics is on a Mac. They have no communication whatsoever. So I would just like to suggest, besides getting a really nice picture, that they identify the picture properly.
Right, right. That's a very good suggestion.
Well, thanks a bunch.
Well, you should share your thoughts with the editors at the newspaper.
Well, I have done that, but they don't seem to care. I've been in the media a couple hundred times, and believe me, once they get done with you, they're done with you. They don't want to see you or talk to you until the next time they want an article.
Right, you know? Right.
They just toss you out like yesterday's news. And I'm not joking, and it's in every country that I've done it in, too.
Right.
Except maybe France.
Uh-huh.
France seemed to be a little bit nicer.
Well, the French are better than us.
Yeah, just ask them. They'll tell you.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
I appreciate
thank
you. That. If that goes into your little blurb that you give, it'll make things work a little better.
Absolutely.
Sure. Thanks again.
All yeah.
Right, thank you.
No, I mean, he's absolutely right. There's no question. And, you know, one of the things I do with my students is, you know, they have to write captions with everything, and I am forever harping on them. One of the things that one of the areas that I think goes most wrong in captions is that one, that we don't really have enough information. We haven't gathered enough information when we shot the photo to write an intelligent caption. because captions are very difficult to write. They have to fit a ton of information, usually in only two sentences. Mm-hmm. So I try to get it through to my students that you need to conduct an interview with the person, essentially, so that you can write this caption, because you'll be sitting at the computer writing your caption and realize, oh my God, I didn't ask, you know, what that device was that he was using. I thought it was a microscope, but looking at it now, it looks like something a little bit more involved than that. Or I didn't ask the name of the process that they were doing or whatever. And so, I mean, I really try to hit them hard on that, because the caller was absolutely right that captions can, you know, either make or break a photo. And unfortunately, sometimes they break the photo rather than making it. Mm.
Do the photographers choose the pictures? Or does an editor choose the picture?
It depends on the paper. Usually it's a combo deal where the photographer does kind of a first edit, and then the editor will look at the photos with them, and hopefully together they come up with what the best shot's going to be. Sometimes the reporter or news editor will help a little bit, but usually not so much.
Mm. And generally it is the photographer that writes the caption, or at least roughs the
caption. Yeah, usually the photo person, the photojournalist writes the caption, and then it gets sent up to the copy desk where all the copy goes through, and then it gets touched up from there. One of the rules I tell my students is that you must have the photo in front of you as you write the caption. And two, if a lot of my students end up being copy editors or reporters or whatever, I tell them that if you have a question about how the caption matches up with the photo, you must talk to the photographer rather than making assumptions about what you see in the photo. Mm. Because it's real easy to say, oh, you know, it's not the classic cliche, which I'm growing tired of, you know, a photo's worth 1,000 words, right? So they go, oh, I can just look at this photo and tell exactly what's happening. The problem is that because of problems in perspective, the fact that it goes from a three-dimensional world to the two-dimensional photo, all kinds of problems can be introduced by having people not talk to the photographer if they have questions about that caption. So I appreciate the caller's comments.
All right. Our guest this morning, Brian Johnson, teaches photojournalism at the University of Illinois, and as I mentioned beginning of the show, has also been a newspaper photographer himself. He worked for our paper here, the News Gazette, and every once in a while he's on the show and we talk about cameras and photography, and your questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone to talk with in Aurora next, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly came at the right time. I have a dilemma.
Okay.
I've been taking pictures of the flowers in my garden, and I didn't know whether to take one picture or the group or how to do it.
Sure.
Against the sun. And now I have 3 Siberian iris, which is a flower about almost 3 inches across. Very exquisite flower, and there are only 3. The rain really hasn't helped them, and
I had
hoped that I would have more there to take care of. Now, I'll let you tell me, what angle do I take these pictures from?
Sure, sure. So here are some ideas. One, either take the photos earlier in the morning, up until maybe, you know, let's say 9:30 or 10 o'clock.
Okay.
And then, or later on in the evening, maybe starting about, I don't know, 4 o'clock or so. Try to have the sun coming over one of your shoulders. And what that'll do is it'll give you what we call three-quarter light. Sometimes it's also called Rembrandt lighting, where you have some highlights and some shadows that help give a little bit of depth to your photo.
So my right shoulder?
Either your right shoulder or left shoulder. It just depends. You'll have to look at the flowers and say, you know, what's the best side of this flower? And, you know, would it be better if it's over my left shoulder, which I don't know, let's say that's the morning light, or my right shoulder, which might be the evening light. You just have to kind of think about how the light's going to strike that. Mm-hmm. And know that there'll be a highlight side on the side the sun strikes and then a shadow side on the other side. If you also take it, you know, earlier in the morning or later in the day, you'll have a more dramatic lighting on the flowers, which a little bit more dramatic lighting.
Oh, dramatic.
Mm-hmm, on the flowers, because the sun will be at kind of a lower angle. So it'll accentuate the shadows a little bit more, which can give the depth to the petals and the all the rest of the flower.
How close should I be?
Some of it will depend on how close to the object your camera can focus.
Uh-huh.
That's a big problem, is that sometimes we try to get in close and compose our photo, but it's closer than that particular lens can focus.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, that's my problem.
Yeah, so what you should try to do is are you looking right through the lens, or is there a little window that you're looking through to look at the picture?
There's a window.
Okay. If you can find the instruction manual, it'll tell you how close you can focus on things.
Mm-hmm.
But what you could do is you could take some photos, you know, maybe, you know, 3 feet away, maybe one at 2 feet away, then another one at 1 foot away, and just hopefully somewhere within that range you'll still be within the range of focus of your camera. Now, one other thing to think about, since you're looking at the image through a little window, sometimes there's something that's called parallax error, or in other words, if the window's to one side or the other of the lens, the closer you get to the object, the little window shows you one view, but the lens is really over to the side a little bit, so there's a little bit of error in how things line up.
Uh-huh.
So for those closer shots, usually in the viewfinder there are a couple little dashed lines on either one side or the other of the viewfinder, and what that set of dashed lines is telling you, if you're close to your subject, you have to frame it within the viewfinder, but don't have anything going outside of those dashed lines, because it'll probably get cut off when you take the picture.
Okay.
So, but that's, I mean, if I were to worry about something, I wouldn't worry about that as much as I'd just worry about how the light is striking the flowers.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. This business of light, this is the kind of thing that photographers, artists, videographers, they think about all the time.
Right.
Everybody else, yeah, you don't think about
right.
it that much. But the issue is that particularly your good light is early and late, because around the middle of the day, when the sun gets right
straight overhead,
then it flattens stuff out. And when you're already dealing with a medium that's flat, you want to do everything you can to accentuate
right.
depth in the picture.
Right. You know, it's funny that the light can be flat, but it's also because it's all sun coming from straight overhead, but it's also kind of a contrasty light in that the sun is passing through the least amount of the Earth's atmosphere, usually at high noon. So the light tends to be, you know, bright. So you have really bright highlights, and the shadows that are there are very, very dense. Whereas if the sun's a little bit lower in the sky, the light tends to be a little bit softer, partially because it has more of the atmosphere it has to pass through. So, yeah, for all those reasons, that, you know, earlier and later is usually better light. And so much of what makes a, quote, good photograph, you know, in the casual sense of that term good, is that it has beautiful light in that mm-hmm. photo. That's frequently what can really make the difference between a photo that's okay to look at, shows your subject, but is just that, just your subject, as compared to the shot of the same object that has nice light. You can all of a sudden look at it and go, that is a beautiful picture. You know, look at how, you know, graceful the shadows are falling. And I tell my students that shadows are our friends. Just as a way to make...
I suppose they roll their eyes.
Yeah, they do a little bit and snicker, because I tell them that it's one of my corny little phrases. And it is pretty corny, but it's true, is that so often people are used to thinking about, oh, I've got to get rid of the shadows. Shadows are bad in photos, because so often people are shooting at high noon and the shadows aren't very appealing. But if you use shadows to your advantage, it can really add to the three-dimensional look of that object and really highlight it. Mm-hmm. So it's so important to really look for the light. If people are going out just looking for photos, another thing that I mention is that if they're walking and what they're looking at is a scene with nice light falling on it, then if you find a photo Which you're likely to do no matter which way you walk, you'll find a photo. But if you're walking so that you're looking at the scenes with good light, then the picture you find will have that nice light on it. So if people think about having the sun coming over one of their shoulders, that's the easiest way to think of it. In the early days of photography, when the infamous Brownie camera was around, the saying was, keep the sun to your back. Well, that's so that they would have light and there would be enough light to take the picture. Well, now we can move it one step forward and say, okay, so we want enough light. That's true. Most of the films today are fast enough. We're going to have enough light one way or another. But to get good light, if the sun's coming over one of your shoulders, then you'll have a highlight side and a shadow side just because of the way the sun's going to fall on your object. So the light has to kind of come diagonally across your subject, I guess, is the way to think of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Our guest is Brian Johnson. He teaches photojournalism at the University of Illinois. So this is your opportunity to ask about film, cameras, lenses, or technique. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL.
You know, one thing, I was looking at a photo magazine recently, and I'm not much of a filter guy. I don't, use a lot of creative filters to do this and that, because partially because I'd rather shoot the photo straight, and if I want to do some creative effects, I'd rather have a nice, clean negative to work with up front. But I noticed that a company, there's a type of photo that has that real kind of grainy look, that real, sort of stylized, extra grainy look.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a company called Sunpac who's known for making flash units and things. They have this filter that you can put. This is kind of bizarre. It's a filter you put right against the film plane, right against the shutter, inside your camera. And then you put your, film over it. And it adds grain to your photographs for you. Because, all the film these days is so fine-grained, it's hard to sort of just through the film, get that effect. So they have these pro-grain filters that you put in the camera, in the camera right next to your shutter, mm-hmm. and they have medium grain and coarse grain, and I'm pretty sure you have to leave it in for the whole roll of film, because otherwise you can't open up the back of your camera to change your filter. So I thought that was something I hadn't really thought about the need for, but I suppose that some people might think that's a really cool gimmick.
Uh-huh. So if you want something that has a lot of texture, I guess.
Yeah, well, it sort of has that, old photo, or sometimes that kind of coarse photo that, some line of greeting cards, they have, like the picture of the ballerina with the real grainy sort of sepia-toned look to it.
So. Well, and that's in the example that they have here in the ad in the magazine.
Exactly.
Is that black and white, or is it more
sepia? It's kind of a sepia tone, yeah. So
what that would look like if you were using color film.
I don't know. We'd have to see that. We'd have to buy the filter and try that out.
Okay. Couldn't you still go out and, if you wanted that effect, couldn't you still go out and buy film that would give
There are
you
some
that?
High-speed films that you could definitely use. That would be the easiest thing. The other thing is if you work with a computer at all and you're scanning in any of your images in Photoshop, for instance, you can add noise to your photo. That would, be a lot of the same look.
Okay. We've got a couple of people here. We're lined up, ready to go. Back to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a general question about portraits that they shoot of people.
Yes.
So usually if you look in professional photographers, when they shoot people, they have this kind of a glossy look that's coming on the side of the face. It's as if light is like coming from the side or something.
Right.
I'm just wondering, is it possible for us to, if I have just a simple automatic camera, and I want to shoot such a picture, is it possible? I mean, is there anything that I should do in order to get such a picture?
Sure. I think sometimes that look on just the side of the face is, there's a highlight right there. That's creating that look. So one of the best things that's happened to the hobbyist photographer lately is the widespread availability of halogen work lights. So you can go to your local, you know, Lowe's or Menards or Home Depot or whatever you have. And you can get one of these halogen work lights for, you know, $19 or whatever. And it's an incredibly powerful light, but you can try using that light, have it, you can either bounce it off of a wall and have it be kind of a soft light. Or you could have it go direct on the person's face. And, you know, you can experiment with that light to try to get exactly that kind of look.
How would you do it if you're doing out in the sunlight, I mean, natural light? Would you have to use some kind of reflector?
Yeah, exactly. And you know what you can use? You can even just get a white T-shirt. Even if you had a piece of cardboard, you could put that T-shirt over it. Sometimes also the accordion folding cardboard that people put in their car windows to keep the sun up. Yeah, that's that also can be a really great reflector. And then what you can do is you can either, you know, tape it up to a wall or a pole or a stand or something, or you can have someone help you hold the reflector, and you can have the sun coming in from one side and have it then the reflector on the other side and reflect that light back in the person's face.
So, so the thing is, like, will the photo be like kind of dark on one side and like much more lighter on the other side on the person's face?
Yeah, and, you know, you can experiment with it. I mean, you know, you can have the person be in shade and have a person holding the reflector who's in the sun kind of reflecting some of the light back into the shade. There's all kinds of different techniques, and it just takes a little bit of experimentation to see what you can come up with.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to Muhammad. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question about a project I'm trying to put together where I take photographs and mixed media and sort of attach them to, in this case, a door, and then take a photograph of the door. And the idea is I'd then like take the picture, that picture, and make it into some sort of semi-poster or maybe even just a large photograph. Can you tell me a way to go about that? There are some clues about a way to go about that, and maybe somebody in town that would be involved with making the final poster or something?
Sure. You know what? In the Champaign-Urbana area here, there's a place called Film Processing Limited. And they just got an amazing printer that will print images on photographic paper. And I believe, I'm trying to think of the width, but I think the width is 96 inches wide. And the paper comes on a roll, so it can print a very long, you know, so you could almost print like a full-size picture of this door with the photos on it. Yeah, and what they want is they want a digital file, 300 dots per inch, hopefully at the actual size that you want the final picture to be. So if you had a file that was going to be 96 inches wide by however long at 300 dots per inch, it would be a gargantuan file. So you would definitely want to talk to them beforehand to see kind of what the parameters would be, but it's a really cool printer. It'll, you know, it'll take the scan. They can even scan the picture for you right there. But then it'll print it out on photographic paper, really is almost as large as you could conceive of. Yeah.
Is it pricey? Ballpark?
You know, they just got it, and they're working out the pricing. I didn't think the pricing seemed that outrageous. You know, they've got to price it by the square foot because that's on a roll and all that. But it wasn't really that much more at all than just a conventional print printed at about the same size. But, you know, it is a little bit more because the machine itself was, you know, incredibly expensive. But that would definitely be a good thing to check into.
Thanks a lot. That's very good. You know, just a minor question is, this would work with a non-digital photograph, right?
Print,
like, they can work from that.
Because, as I say, I mean, they can scan it for you. It does need to be scanned at some point. But if you don't have that equipment, that's no big deal. They can do it for you. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Other questions are welcome. Our guest this morning is Brian Johnson. He teaches photojournalism at University of Illinois. And if you have questions about cameras, film, lenses, photographic technique, that's what we're all about here on the show. And you can call in 333-WILL or 9455. And for these people who might be calling long distance, 800-222-WILL. We talked before about some of the things that people might want to think about if they're using a kind of a point-and-shoot camera that's
yes.
going to fix its own exposure.
Right.
And we've talked about some of the problems with what happens when you take pictures with that indoors. Now
right.
that we're moving into the season where people are going to be outdoors,
right.
there's sort of maybe different, same problem but different issues, particularly if you're taking pictures and there's a lot of contrast where there's
right.
whatever it's looking at, there's areas that are lighter and areas that are darker, because the camera's got to figure out, okay, how do I, what exposure do I do on this? And it seems that it's really easy to get it either underexposed or overexposed.
Sure. You know, one thing that's really great about the advancement of technology and photo stuff is that the cameras now do such a great job of integrating a flash exposure with the daylight exposure. And one thing that people can do if they have a point-and-shoot camera is use the flash even if they're outdoors. You know, usually what are we shooting pictures of? Well, hopefully we're shooting pictures of people, because that's what other people like to look at. So if you're taking a picture of someone at a vacation site, let's say, thing number one, get the people very close to you. So get the people from maybe like the waist up or even the chest up in your frame. Have them over in one side of the frame, either the left side or the right side, and then have the background, the scene, over in the other two-thirds of that picture. Then if you can have your camera, if you can force it to use the flash, that way, even if there are harsh shadows on the person's face, the flash will help fill in those shadows so it doesn't look so harsh anymore. And that's called fill flash. And because the cameras are so advanced in their technology, they do a good job balancing that daylight exposure for the scene and the flash exposure that ends up being on the person. And especially if you get the person from the chest up or so, they're close enough for that flash to work effectively. So that's, I think, a really good technique for all those, you know, pictures that we're always shooting of, you know, here I am in Acapulco or, you know, Disney World or wherever that people happen to be. So get the people up close so we can see what they look like, use the flash, and then have the scene kind of in the other two-thirds of that photo where the person isn't. And I think that works out really well. If we're doing just sort of the landscape or the classic kind of tourist photo, if people could try one of two different techniques that both involve their position, if they can get down on a very, very low angle and shoot the photo, or maybe try to get up in a building, maybe, you know, if the lifeguards are off duty, they can stand on the lifeguard's tower or something to get a high angle. So varying the angle that they shoot the picture at can really dramatically improve the interest factor of that image, so that everything's just not shot at, you know, however tall their eyes are, you know, 5'6", you know, 4'11", or whatever. So changing the angle can have a dramatic effect. And then what we talked about before, just being very aware of the light that's falling on it. Now, maybe not shooting other photos during midday when they're out, but maybe take some when they first go out and then save some film for later on in the end of the day when the sun gets lower in the sky. So yeah. That can add a lot of interest also.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of people, your impulse, if you're going to take a picture of something, you stand right in front of it.
Right.
Right square to it.
Right.
And you
about 25 to 50 feet away.
Yeah.
And get those people out of the way. I'm trying to take a picture. Right. And that's the biggest mistake that they make, that they're trying to eliminate all the people. And especially if they're, you know, traveling abroad anywhere, having pictures of the people in the photograph is a lot of times what's going to add interest. You know, well, what are the fashions, you know, in Germany right now? You know, how many people were there? What kind of day was it? So often we just think about taking pictures of things. And if people could think about taking pictures of moments that have the thing in the background, maybe, that would be better. So at the beach, so we do our nice portrait shot of the kids, you know, in the beach, but then maybe get some shots of them while they're, you know, playing with the beach ball, you know, so you get in close to the kids, maybe just get one of the kids, you know, as they're just catching the ball or something, then you've got the ocean in the background. I mean, that can add a lot of interest. The thing is, that's going to use more film. And I think that's what people are always afraid of doing. And I do this when I have a, you know, my point and shoot cameras. You know, I might have a roll of film in the camera for 6 months. Now I have, you know, three or four point and shoot cameras kind of scattered everywhere, so I can always grab one that has film in it. But if you're going to shoot photos, you have to think about, well, why am I shooting this photo? What's the point of it? Mm-hmm. So often I think people think, I have to shoot photos. I'm on vacation. Instead of saying, well, you know what? Maybe if I thought about the times I'm going to take these photos so that I could concentrate on taking photos while I'm taking photos, but then enjoy my vacation for the rest of the time, rather than spending so much time documenting everything that you essentially miss the vacation. You think, oh, well, I can, you know, read the details of this when I get back home. And the truth of the matter is, you don't do that. You just take all these pictures, you know, shuffle through them once or twice and force your family and friends to look at them once or twice, and then you don't see them. But if you shot a few photos, let me rephrase that. Let's say you take a few situations and work those situations a little bit more, then you could come up with maybe a more dramatic photo, a more interesting photo, one that you maybe want to then enlarge and keep out. And then you can also enjoy the rest of your vacation because you're not shooting just everything that crosses in front of you, but you're thinking, you know, okay, is this a good photo? Why would I want to shoot this photo? What is it about this that's making me shoot it? You know, maybe it's a museum and it's a really neat old airplane, or maybe it's a really unusual plant of some sort. So I think that's probably the way to approach it.
We got plenty of time here for other questions. If you have thoughts about photography, and either you want to talk about the hardware or the business of what you actually do, how you point that camera, how you think about putting together a photograph, our guest is Brian Johnson. He teaches photojournalism at the University of Illinois, and every once in a while is here, and we do these programs, and we thought maybe this would be a good time of year. People would be thinking about possibly going on vacation and wanting to take pictures to bring home of the experiences. So any questions you might have, anything that has to do with photography, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Some years ago, I'm sure I've told you about this, but maybe more than one. Some years ago, I had the opportunity to talk with Galen Rowell.
Uh-huh.
He's a real
amazing,
famous photographer.
Amazing shooter.
And has done just an amazing photograph. So I talked to him, and I saw this book that was a collection of his photographs. And something that, as I was looking at them, really struck me in photograph after photograph, at least it seemed to me, was that there were, in his pictures, there are three very distinct regions. There's a very strong foreground, there's a very strong midground, and there's a very strong background.
Right.
And, of course, they're all in focus. And I thought, well, no, that's really interesting. I never really thought about it until I started looking at the pictures, realizing, yeah, they're really, it seems like a very deliberate,
exactly,
these three places in the photograph.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, that's what gives that photograph the depth. You know, if you shoot that portrait shot of someone close to the camera, and then you have the background, you know, again, that's kind of that foreground background. It kind of leads people then into the frame. Mm-hmm. So the other thing about a lot of his photos is he has amazing light. He has a photo that he shot, I believe it's in Tibet,
where there's the rainbow. Yeah.
And if you have ever read or heard him tell the story about that, he saw that happening, and he was running through the underbrush as fast as he could to catch that moment, and he just barely caught it. But he was running to align the rainbow so that it would look like it was just coming perfectly into that monastery that was in that photo.
I think it's the Palace of the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
And yes, and it looks like the end of the rainbow looks like
just
it comes
right
down right
into
there.
It. Yeah. And you know, but again, he was conscious of, it's not just enough that the rainbow is there, but, you know, he did that last little detail that made that kind of the perfect photograph, rather than just, you know, kind of a snapshot of what could have been a perfect photograph.
Yeah, that was one of those ones you got to figure, it just happens to be luck.
Luck.
He knew how to take the picture,
but then he made his own luck by hauling his rear end over to try to get that shot lined up just the way it should be.
Yeah. Okay. That's it. Yeah, it's an amazing picture. Here's a caller to talk with in Muncie, line number one. Hello.
Hi, Vince Lombardi said luck was when opportunity met preparation, so it seemed.
Yep.
Very good.
That's very good.
I was wondering about digital video cameras and
sure.
To buy one, what you recommend?
Uh-huh. Well, there's sort of the format wars going on now. There's the mini DV format. There's a DV cam format. Panasonic has DVC Pro. So there are kind of these fighting. Oh, and there's also Digital 8 that Sony came out with, which I thought was, well, I mean, I suppose it makes a good sense in some ways, but doesn't really make that much sense overall. Anyway, so what I would look for, I would look for a camera that shoots in the mini DV format.
Okay.
I would also look to be sure that it had a FireWire port. Sometimes it's called IEEE 1394. Sony and Panasonic call it iLink. But what that connection allows you to do is plug a cable in your camera and then a cable into your computer and digitally transfer the data from the tape to the computer.
Okay.
So you definitely want to look for that.
FireWire.
Yes, FireWire or iLink or, you know, IEEE 1394, which is the, you know, standard. That's the specification for the standard. You know, things like the LCD monitor are nice to have. A lot of them have image stabilization. I tend to prefer the optical stabilizers rather than the electronic stabilizers. Canon, and I just read there's another company that has the optical stabilizer where it actually takes one of the lens elements and jiggles it in the exact opposite movement of where you're jiggling the camera so that it stabilizes the image. Whereas the Sony technique, it electronically does it, and it's not, I don't think it's quite as good as
okay.
that. And, you know, some of the cameras are really small. Maybe that's important if it's going to be kind of a travel camera you just want to slip in your pocket. Some of the cameras also have a little memory card slot that you can use. I think Sony calls it memory stick, and I think that Panasonic or JVC or one of them have one of the other manufacturers has also started including that. I think Canon too actually now have the little memory stick slot. That's I don't think it's that useful, but maybe it's useful if you're going to do some, try to do some still images with your digital video camera. Just know that the images you get with a digital video camera are not going to be as good as the images you would get with, you know, mid-priced, just regular still video, still digital camera. But you can do still images with your video camera.
Right.
So,
and as far as images for your regular as a video.
Right.
It's superior?
Say that again.
Is it superior for the digital video, I presume, is superior to the regular?
To like the high 8 or 8 yeah. millimeter. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, the high 8 cameras come pretty close to the digital cameras, but the real advantage is that since it's recorded digitally, if you have a computer, you can, you know, take that digital video file into your computer. You know, all Macintoshes come with a program called iMovie 2, where you can edit your own little home movies incredibly easily and then output them back to the camera in full resolution. So the resolution, the sound is very, very good with digital video cameras. And it is better than high 8, definitely, and definitely much better than the regular 8 millimeter.
Thank you very much.
All yeah, right, sure.
Thanks for the call. We're coming down here into about our last 10 minutes. Brian Johnson is our guest. He's professor of journalism here at the U of I, where he teaches photojournalism and occasionally is on the program here. We talk about cameras and photography. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Next is a caller in Gays, in Illinois, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. No matter what I do, I cannot get away from flashbulb eyes in dog pictures.
Okay. Thing number one is to try to turn on as many lights in the room as you possibly can. If you can make it as bright as possible in the room, that helps the pupils constrict on the eyes of humans, you know, dogs, cats, whatever. The other thing you can do, and it depends on your camera, but if you have a camera where you can have a separate flash unit from the camera, then you can also get what's called a flash extension cord, or sometimes it's called an off-camera cord. So then the further away from the camera lens you can have the flash, the better off you're going to be as far as eliminating that red eye effect. So if you can have that off-camera cord, then you can hold the flash up. As David can look at me with a puzzled look, if you hold the flash up, you know, at arm's length overhead as you're taking the picture, then as the light comes into the animal's eyes, it's reflected off on that similar angle, and that'll reduce the incidence of that red eye.
Okay, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
All right, and to Urbana here, line three. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'm interested in what you know about the longevity of prints that have been printed out on an inkjet computer, onto photo paper.
Sure.
You know, inkjet printer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you could be looking at anywhere from 10 days to 100 years. Yeah, and, you know, what's the great thing that's been happening is that the companies have realized that the longevity of inkjet prints stinks. And so Epson was the first one to come out with some really stable inks where they have their Epson Stylus Photo 2000P that has prints that supposedly last over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hewlett-Packard has just come out with some pigmented inks that are supposedly very long-lived also.
What kind of inks?
They are under different kind of names, but a lot of times they're called pigmented inks. Sometimes they're, you know, they call them UV stable inks and things like that. But a lot of the newer printers have much better longevity. Some of the first batch of inkjet printers, like the one I have in my office at home, you know, they can start fading within a matter of weeks.
How about the 832? Do you know about that one?
I don't offhand. But, you know, if you go to their website and check it out, that, you know, a lot of times they'll, if it's one of the ones that has long live prints, they'll definitely be boasting about it.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. All right. And to Elliot, next caller here, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Are those panoramic one-use cameras any good to take pictures?
You know, they're kind of fake panoramas. Any of the point, well, I shouldn't say any. 99% of the point and shoot cameras, including the disposable ones.
Yes.
All that they're doing is they have kind of a wide angle lens, but it's really not a panorama. All that they do then is they kind of crop off the top and the bottom of the picture and give you a long, skinny picture. So they aren't really panoramas in the true sense of the word. It's really more of a wide-angle picture where they've printed it in a long, skinny way to make it look like a panorama.
Oh, so I assume you don't recommend those at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you can take a picture with any camera and just put the horizon line right in the center of the picture, and then you could tell your photo finisher, oh, this was taken with a panorama camera. And then they'll, you know, make these, you know, 2-inch, you know, tall by 5-inch wide, or, you know, sometimes they're, you know, 3x10 or whatever they are. And they just crop off the top of the picture and the bottom of the picture to give you a long, skinny picture.
Oh, uh-huh. Well, what about those one-time cameras that say you have to take them in the sunlight? Are those any good?
Yeah, you know, I mean, actually, most of the one-time cameras are, you know, really not too bad. And especially, you know, having that camera as opposed to having no camera. You know, I'd much rather have a camera, even if it's a disposable. But, you know, the quality is actually not too bad with those cameras.
Okay, well, that's good. That would be good for children to learn to use.
Absolutely. Perfect use for those.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thanks. Well, I have a couple of other people here, but I had an off-air question. Maybe I want to try to get in here quick, and you can talk about it for a minute, and we'll see if we can get at least one more caller. Earlier, we were talking about technique, and we were talking about cases where the thing you were taking a picture of is standing still.
Right.
Somebody wants to know if there are some things you can say about action photos, things
right.
where sporting events, car right. races, whatever, where the
right.
objects are moving.
Right. Telephoto lens, thing number one. So, you know, if it's a telephoto zoom lens, you know, usually you're going to want something at least 200 millimeters for the, you know, zoom. So that will let you stay in a safe place while the action takes place mm-hmm. in front of you. The other thing is that a lot of the cameras now have a sports photography mode. So you put it in that mode, and what the camera will do is tend to accentuate more the high shutter speeds. So that you'll be more likely to stop the action. So either put it in the sports photo mode or put it in the mode where you can set the shutter speed and try to set a shutter speed of maybe a thousandth of a second, anything over 250th of a second. So 250, 500, 1,000, 2,000, even, you know, 4,000 or 8,000 if your camera has it and if it's bright enough.
Okay. So you think in a photo like that, the most important issue really is being able to stop the action?
Usually, yes. And the other important issue is just being able to get close enough to the action so that it's not just a little, you know, pinprick on your film. So the telephoto lens is probably the most important thing. And then stopping the action in very general terms is what people are going to try to do.
I'm trying to get one more here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to that question on outputting from the digital video camera.
Yes,
What if you've got grandparents who have an old TV and an old VCR, and you want to show, you know, send them some
sure.
video?
Uh-huh.
Can you output from a digital onto, like, VHS?
Yes, you can, and that's what's so great about it is that, you know, you can just plug your camera in to your VHS deck, and, you know, you press play in your digital camera and press record on the VHS VCR, and there's your tape to send to Grandma and Grandpa.
Okay, so you could record it in your house here in Urbana, for example.
Yes, exactly.
And mm-hmm. make a VHS tape.
Yeah, it's really simple.
Ah, okay, and then send that VHS tape to whoever.
Right, right. I've done that lots of times.
Okay, and,
uh-huh.
and that's off one of those, what you were talking about, the mini digital?
Right, the mini DV cameras, right. And even, you know, the Hi8 cameras and all that can do the same thing.
Okay. Okay, so if I got the mini digital, then you were saying to have that FireWire?
FireWire is good if you're going to take the image in, you know, work with the video in a computer at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just going to go straight out to a VHS deck, what you want to be sure that the digital camera, most of them have this, but be sure they have analog outputs.
Analog output,
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yeah, most of them do, but just check to
just
be sure.
Double check.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much. And I'm sorry, we got one person we can't take, but I'm sure on another day Brian will come back.
Oh, yeah.
For the moment, thank you.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Brian Johnson, he's professor of journalism at University of Illinois.